Madeline's mother described her as well-traveled, well-educated, and a fun-loving woman who is always willing to give someone a second chance. This situation happened because she did give everyone a second chance. She was trying to get out of this relationship. She did love him, but she knew she needed to get out of it.
As advocates, we know that when survivors give their abusive partners multiple chances, the abuse tends to escalate. We encourage anyone who is experiencing domestic violence to reach out for help and help end the cycle of domestic violence.
Welcome to Local Motion. I'm Allie Lightfoot. You just heard representatives from Hilltop Domestic Violence Services speaking at a vigil they held last Thursday for a Hotchkiss woman who was killed in June. The service was for Madeline Lowe. On or about June 19th, her boyfriend Edgar Macias Moreno allegedly strangled her to death during an argument at their Hotchkiss camping trailer. He then used her vehicle to drive her body to Utah, where he dumped it. Macias Moreno was formally charged with first-degree murder. If he's convicted, it will bring a mandatory life sentence without parole. He's also charged with concealing a death and cruelty to animals, Class 1 misdemeanors. I spoke with Leslie Sparks, Hilltop's Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Program Supervisor, about their agency's role in hosting the vigil.
I think it's important that we have a presence, that our agency has a presence, so that in the midst of this tragedy, that maybe somebody else can get the information that they need to get out of the abusive relationship that they're in.
And just looking at the few details that we have about this case, what were some red flags that you could tell were there from looking at it? And what would be the best thing to do if you noticed any of these things happening in a relationship?
Well, I can't speak specifically to this case. I can give you some red flag warnings in general. Especially for people that are maybe just starting to date someone, you're looking for love bombing, somebody that's coming on really strong and really fast. You're looking for somebody that's controlling. They want to know where you are, who you're with, who you're talking to. They might look at your phone or your email accounts without your permission. Isolate you from friends or family, want you to be all about them. And, you know, a lot of times abusers tell us really what they mean in things like saying you're too good for me. If somebody's telling you that, believe them. You know, these are all warning signs.
Hilltop Tri-County Resources works to help those affected by domestic violence and sexual assault. The agency serves Delta, Montrose, and Ouray counties. They provide 24-hour crisis lines, emergency shelters, legal advocacy, support groups, case management, children's services, and transitional housing. In Delta County, deputies responded to 59 domestic violence calls in 2017 and 37 thus far in 2018. Montrose County deputies responded to 64 domestic violence calls in 2017 and 28 so far this year. I spoke with Jackie Sievers, director of Hilltop Domestic Violence Services, about the issue of domestic abuse in our area, why numbers may be rising, and what the community can do to help.
Hilltop has services for survivors of domestic abuse as well as sexual assault. So we have a 24/7 crisis line. So somebody experiencing abuse can call that, but so can people whose loved ones are experiencing abuse if they would like some to talk through it or some advice, and also professionals who need to connect with our team immediately can use that service. We offer safe housing for people who are at imminent risk as a result of that abuse. And then we have groups and we have navigation and case management and advocacy really to help people move through what's happened to them and really thrive and go to a place that they want to be.
Most people probably think they know what domestic abuse is. But what are some of the misconceptions or parts of that definition that some people may not know?
I think most people picture physical abuse when they think of domestic violence. And typically, emotional abuse is the most prevalent form, and it's where really everything starts. So it's about obtaining power and control over that other person, diminishing their self-worth, isolating them from supports. So those are really critical components of the abuse and make it really hard to seek help. There's also financial abuse, where they're withholding, the abusers are withholding money, resources, medical abuse, so denying the partner access to a physician or emergency care. And then there's a lot of sexual assault that happens within a domestic violence relationship as well.
I know a lot of people, when they end a relationship, feel that it's important to, in order to respect the person that you're ending the relationship with, that you should do it in person, or, you know, that you should offer them friendship after that relationship, or, you know, that it should be done in a certain way. If you feel that your partner at that point is a danger to you, how do you end a relationship? What is the best way to end a relationship in that situation?
We would recommend getting to safety first, and not making contact, not having that in-person conversation. And you're right, people want to do that. They want to be respectful and thoughtful often. So planning ahead, having emergency documents, money, IDs, things like that put together, and just go. Get safe, get your feet under you a little bit, and then you can access expert help on how to engage with the other person and that, and still be safe.
So I looked at some statistics, and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence reported, and these are numbers from 2014, that one in three women and one in four men in the United States have experienced some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. On a typical day, domestic violence hotlines receive up to 21,000 calls, an average of close to 15 calls a minute. Intimate partner violence accounts for 15% of all violent crime. The presence of a gun in a home during domestic violence incident increases the risk of homicide by 500%. 72% of all murder suicides involve an intimate partner, and 94% of the victims of these crimes are female. Can you talk a little bit about the numbers in the counties that Hilltop serves, which, to remind people, that's Delta, Montrose, and Ouray counties? Have you noticed anything happening in the past couple of years that's different? Do we have a higher rate than other counties in Colorado?
We receive about 100 calls a month through our crisis line serving that three-county area. We are seeing an increase of about 34% over the last year, so the numbers keep ticking up a little bit. Our safe house utilization has gone up as well. And our walk-ins, so people who just need some immediate help and walk into our office, that is on the rise. So we're seeing about 70 people on a walk-in basis every month in our Montrose office. And we're serving about five adults in our safe house every month. And typically people stay 2 to 4 weeks in our safe house, so that would be five new individuals every month. Mm-hmm. So trending, it is going up, not as fast as some other areas in the state and in the country. The Me Too movement really has heightened awareness of abuse in general and access to service, and we are seeing a delayed increase, I think, with that movement.
Do you know if the United States has a higher number than other countries?
I don't know that. And all the laws are different and the reporting would be different. Mm-hmm. I do know that when we serve immigrants who are from countries that where domestic violence is legal, we see a much lower reporting here in the United States. So Middle Eastern countries, for example, if you have an immigrant woman from that area, she's much less likely to report to our law enforcement.
So what are the causes? Do you think there is a connection between poverty and domestic violence? Do you think gun culture, the media play any role with all the research that you've seen and sort of the psychological makeup of an abuser, what are they finding out?
There are risk factors, certainly, for abusive behavior that include some of the things you listed. So poverty is one, unemployment is another. Mental health disorders can be an indicator, particularly personality disorders. But there are also people within those categories who aren't abusive. So there's no easy answer. There really is a sense of entitlement and power control dynamics within somebody who's abusing.
I want to talk a little bit about the laws in Colorado in domestic violence cases. Here in Colorado, if officers are called out and they have probable cause to believe someone committed an act of domestic violence, the suspect of the crime must be arrested. In addition, the arrested person will be booked into jail and cannot be given a bond until the victim has been informed of the bond hearing and given a right to be heard. Federal law mandates that anyone convicted of a domestic violence charge cannot possess a firearm. If the domestic violence conviction is for a felony, state law also makes it a felony to possess a firearm. And these bans are for a lifetime. Is this all correct?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see these laws being effective? Does it bring numbers down? Or what are people finding out about those laws? Are they being enforced?
Yes, I think they're being enforced. I think there's a lot of misconception about the mandatory arrest law. People tend to think if law enforcement officers are called out on a domestic violence call that they must arrest somebody. But as you said, there has to be probable cause that the crime was committed. And it just ensures the protection of a victim of abuse. So if the officer responds and there's evidence, then they'll make that arrest. And giving that victim the opportunity to have voice before the person's released from jail is really important for their safety. With the gun laws, they were enhanced in our Colorado legislative session recently, and we know that having a gun in the home where domestic violence is occurring drastically increases the likelihood of a fatality, of a domestic violence homicide. So that offender having to give up their weapons during that period while they're engaged in treatment, and as you said, if they're a felony, then it goes beyond that, is aimed at preventing fatalities.
But how do they know if they gave up their weapons?
The weapons law is difficult. The law enforcement and judicial system have to identify what weapons the offender has in their possession. And then each jurisdiction really executes that a little differently. There's not a repository, you know, where all these guns go. And so usually it ends up transferring ownership to somebody that the offender would know. Some jurisdictions in Colorado do choose to store the weapons, but others then do the transfer of ownership.
Abusers are sent to domestic violence classes. What do they learn there? And is there any kind of database that lets people know if they're with someone who's an abuser?
So domestic violence offender treatment in Colorado is a program that is based on the offender learning competencies that will prevent them from engaging in that behavior again in the future. So focuses a lot on power and control, on learning about how to resolve conflict, how to manage themselves, how to mitigate some of those risk factors we talked about. If there's co-occurring issues like substance abuse, it would include treatment for that as well. Colorado's offender treatment is very robust. It's considered one of the leading programs in the nation, and there's some great information about the outcomes from the treatment. There is no database like there is with adult sex offenders where you can go and check, and that information is available through normal means as far as finding out anyone else criminal background.
The story about Madeline Lowe was extremely tragic, and It was pretty much in our backyard here, in our listening area. It happened in Hotchkiss. Yet there wasn't a very big community response to it. What are the benefits of community involvement in this issue? How does a community help the situation, support the victim, take part in this issue in a way that's beneficial or helpful? Just in a small way, how can people help? Because I feel like right now there's so many things going on nationally, internationally, with the environment and so on, that people lose focus of what's happening in their backyard.
I think there's a lot that we can do within our community to work on the issue. And so some of the more typical ways might be volunteering in local organizations, donating, those kind of paths. What we hear from survivors that is absolutely the most helpful is people connecting with them. They are in a position where they're not seen as people. They're not acknowledged as equals. So being connected means everything. And that isolation that occurs with the domestic violence is so damaging. It makes it harder and harder to reach out. So anything that I think that promotes connectivity, promotes community, keeping an eye on each other as neighbors. If you hear something that feels like it's crossing the line, calling law enforcement. Be engaged in that way, because the person in that house may not be able to call.
And then just a personal question, because I feel like the kind of work that you do at Hilltop, the outcome isn't always what you would hope it would be. What's the mental strategy to keep going, in a way, when so often it doesn't, you know, a lot of times people go back to their abusers and that kind of thing? So how do you mentally get through that?
Part of it is that there are a lot of success stories, and fortunately there are many people who do connect back with us and say, things are great, here's what's happened. So we hold on tightly to those stories. Most of the time, we don't end up knowing what happens for someone. I think we are passionate about being there when, at the moment, people need us, and we know that that's a moment in time. And if we can do that, we can be there, be a resource, then we're fulfilling our purpose.
And how does domestic abuse affect us in ways that maybe we're unaware of?
Well, most sick days, I shouldn't say most, for survivors of violence, most sick days are directly related to their abuse. There is a high, high cost to our medical world of injuries and therapeutic interventions as a result of the abuse. So it's actually a very high cost issue to our communities, which I think people don't realize. Also, domestic violence offenders are prone to violence with law enforcement, so those tend to be the most dangerous calls that law enforcement go on. And there may be co-occurring crimes with that, so domestic violence may not be the only crime being committed. I think the old model of thinking about domestic violence is it's somebody's family affair, and it's really hard to interject yourself into somebody's family and have judgment about how they're managing themselves. And I would encourage people to remember it goes beyond that. It is impacting our schools, our children, our social services, our medical, our finances as a community.
So in addition to the shelters and safe places that Hilltop provides, what other kinds of services might someone participate in after, you know, the initial separation, where they're just being kept safe? What's the next sort of steps in the process when you're going through that?
The next steps vary by person, but most often include self-sufficiency. So getting a stable income, because somebody may not have been allowed to work, for example. Getting safe and secure housing that they're independent in. taking care of any legal issues, so allocation of parental rights, divorce if that's applicable and desired, and then sometimes navigating through as a witness or the victim of a crime if there's charges against the offender, and that can take quite a bit of time.
Do you only serve people who are leaving their partner?
No, we'll work with anybody who has experienced domestic violence or sexual assault to help them be as safe as they can be and meet their goals. So we don't require that somebody leave their partner. We're not going to push that on anyone. We want to be an asset and a support through their journey.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with Jackie Sievers, who's the director of Hilltop Domestic Violence Services. At Hilltop, which serves Delta, Montrose, and Ouray counties, where can people reach Hilltop?
So our 24-hour crisis line is 844-990-5500 for Delta, Montrose, and Ouray counties. And for Mesa County, it's 970-241-6704.
Thank you for listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Allie Lightfoot. I want to mention finally about a GoFundMe set up for the caretakers of Madeline Lowe's dog, Max. Friends and relatives of Madeline's reported that her 2-year-old blue heeler, Max, was repeatedly beaten and then dumped on the side of Highway 50 by Edgar Macias Moreno. His custom-made collar with a tracking device was taken so Max would not lead the police to her location. Somebody found Max on the side of the road and listed him in the Lost and Found in Grand Junction. This same person has adopted Max. A friend of Madeline's saw Max's photo and went down to claim him. Search at GoFundMe for Max, her beloved dog, to find out more and contribute.